No, he said, I don't want to be a wizard, said Nud.
His voice had grown louder, and he began to pace up to the edge of the river and back, his crossbow swinging in his left hand. Is there something wrong with being a wizard? Aynon asked.
Of course not, said Nud. But I don't want to be one. I don't want to turn out like Damon and my mother.
Grumpy?
Cynical. More concerned with political machinations than helping people.
That makes sense, said Aynon. I'd rather help people than worry about politics myself. He gave Nud a sympathetic look when the big man's pacing brought him back toward Aynon. Nud didn't seem happy, so Aynon tried to distract him.
I understand that your servant act was partly put on for my benefit, but what do you do with your time in Melancarrig when you're not waiting on Damon's every whim?
He's not so bad, said Nud. I spend a lot of time in the library.
If I were stuck in Melancarrig, I'd do the same. What do you like to read?
Histories, philosophy, law books, travellers' tales, poems, story collections, even books of wise sayings like Elderman's epigrams, said Nud, and most of the atlases in the map room.
I envy you the opportunity, said Aynon.
It sounds to me like you're not so much waiting as preparing for something.
Maybe, said Nud, but I wish I knew what.
Turn around slowly.
Huh?
Said Aynon. He saw the concerned look on Nud's face and carefully rotated his body. A dozen wizards, including two calves and a massive shaggy bull, were making their way toward the section of riverbank where Aynon and Nud were standing. Wizards had notoriously bad eyesight, so they hadn't noticed Rocky. They probably thought the wyvern was a large black rock. Humans were small and inconsequential. They could get out of the wizard's way of their own accord, or be pushed aside and trampled like so much sage-grass. There was still a gap of 3 spear lengths between them and the tiny herd. Nud raised his crossbow, then lowered it and put his hand on Iron's shoulder.
"Does the wizard have any ideas?" Nud asked.
"Scream loud enough to wake Rocky?" offered Iron.
"That might make them stampede."
"Fly above them?" asked Iron.
"Good answer," said Nud.
He put on his own pack, attached the crossbow with a strap, and tossed the extra quarrels into his hood. Then he removed Aynon's flying disc from the back of the young wizard's pack and handed it over.
"I'll put that on," said Aynon, indicating his pack.
Nud held the pack up, and Aynon slipped his arms into the straps. He put the flying disc on the ground, stepped on it, and beckoned Nud to stand behind him. Aynon directed the disc to rise, keeping his movements slow and controlled so they didn't frighten the wizards. They soon had enough altitude for the shaggy-horned bovines to pass below them.
"I may have forgotten to tell you that this stretch of bank is also a ford," said Nud. "The river is shallow here, which makes it a good place to pan for gold and for wildlife to get across."
"That's a major oversight," said Aynon.
The cows and calves had reached the water. Their quiet grunts and snorts as they drank didn't disturb the peaceful riverbank. Then the bull came up and drank, while two of the cows watched for predators. Aynon realized the entire herd was about to cross the river at the exact spot where he'd positioned all his gold collection cylinders. He could move the cylinders, but that would set his schedule back. It was time to try something creative. One of the cows was about to step into the river and begin to cross. Aynon used the subtle control of the blue mage stone around his neck to form a wide, stiff sheet of transparent solidified sound beneath the cow's feet. He added power from his red mage stone and extended the sheet until it covered the entire river, gently arching a few feet over the tops of the cylinders. The wizards proceeded across without further incident. Aynon watched them amble up the far bank and enter the forest, unperturbed by their encounter with wizardry. He dispelled the sheet of solidified sound.
"Nicely done," said Nud.
Aynon smiled and gave a small bow, which caused his flying disc to tip precariously. He'd have to remember not to do that again. When they got back to Chi and Rocky, the Raconette opened one eye and nodded at Aynon before going back to sleep. Rocky had napped through it all. Nerd and Einan watched as a family of mule deer stopped to drink from the river. They didn't try to cross and left quickly, with nervous glances at the humans and the large black rock sleeping in the sunlight making rumbling noises. A fox nosed its head around a boulder, inspected the scene and left without getting a drink. Einan was growing hungry, so he opened the basket to see what his family had packed for them to eat. He hoped most of the contents had been prepared by his mother and father rather than his sister. Braith had many talents, but cooking wasn't one of them. If Nud had lived on his own cooking for years, Braith might still be a good match for his friend in a few years. Maybe Einan could teach Nud what he'd never been able to teach his sister about the culinary arts. As soon as he pulled back the cloth covering the basket, Chi was chittering on his shoulder. "You got a whole bag of dried cherries from my mother, and took a bag of dried plums from the castle's kitchen," said Einan. "Wait your turn and let the humans eat first." Nud and Einan leaned against the rock supporting the basket and ate the smoked sausage and cheese and small loaves of dark bread Einan's family had provided. It was simple fare but filling. Chi managed to beg morsels from both of them.
"How long have the cylinders been running?" Nud asked when they had finished their snack.
"Only half an hour," said Einan. "It's probably time to check them again. I'll need to bring one ashore to confirm it's really as full of gold as it looks."
"Damon creates lenses from solidified sound so things farther away look closer and little things look larger," said Nud. "That might save you time."
Einan loved making lenses. He experimented for a few minutes but couldn't make them augment his vision.
"I think Damon might have created them in pairs," added Nud. "Two for each eye."
"That might help," said Einan.
When he tried that option, he felt his blue mage stone pulse in approval. Instead of two lenses, he got four, as Nud had specified. Now he could see Wizants nibbling on new green grass near the forest on the far side of the river. Furcha must have saved a lot of valuable magic in her mage stone. He lifted one of the cylinders in the middle of the river and zoomed in on its collection chamber. It was indeed full of gold dust.
"What do you see?" asked Nud.
Einan reached out to the blue mage stone and generated another pair of double lenses for Nud.
"Look for yourself," said Einan.
"Thank you. I love it," said the big man. "Damon never shared his far eye spell with me. Time to bring the cylinders in?"
"I think so," said Einan.
He heard stones clattering behind him and turned to see a huge animal that looked like a cross between a deer and a wizened making its way down to drink from the river.
"What is that?"
Einan whispered.
"A flat horn," said Nud. "Don't startle it. They can be worse than wizards when they're frightened."
Einan saw that the big animal's antlers were indeed flat, not round and pointed like the deer back in the coombe or the local pronghorns. They made its great head look even bigger.
"They're antlers, not horns," Einan protested.
"Don't blame me," said Nud. "Damon and his wife named the animals and plants near Melyn Carrig before I was born."
"Damon was married?"
"Was married. Is married. I don't know. He doesn't like to talk about it."
"It's certainly hard to get information out of him when he doesn't want to give it," agreed Einan.
Nud stood up when he finished eating. He removed two of the pillowcases from Rocky's back and put one inside the other. Einan tilted his head while his companion was at work.
"I'm making the bags double strong," said Nud. "Gold dust is heavy, and I don't want any to escape when we fly back to the castle to melt it."
"Why do we have to fly back to the castle for that?" asked Einan.
"I can melt and form it with magic."
"I guess you can at that," said Nud. "I still haven't cleaned the gold off the ceiling and floor of the artifact studio."
"I'll help you with that," said Einan.
"Don't bother," said Nud. "Once we leave, I don't think I'm coming back here again."
"Oh," said Einan. He knew he would. There were so many books he wanted to read in the library.
"Does that mean I won't need these pillowcases?" asked Nud.
"It does. I can dump gold dust from the cylinders directly into spheres of solidified sound for heating."
"Why can't you just transform the cylinders into spheres?"
"Maybe I can," said Einan.
He lifted one cylinder out of the water and brought it over to float in the air in front of them. Then Einan made the cylinder shorter, closed its ends, and spun it into a large sphere, adding heat as he did. He moved his hands together like he was squeezing a ball, and the sphere got smaller and even hotter. The gold dust inside melted together and puddled in the bottom of the sphere. Einan spun the sphere around and pushed one of his palms toward the other. The upper and lower parts of the sphere met in the center, turning it into a small ring. Einan inhaled, and his Mage Stone's wizardry chilled and solidified the molten metal. He dispelled the solidified sound construct and caught the gold ring before it could fall. It was about 3 fingers across and as wide as an arrow shaft in cross-section. Einan hefted it and tossed it to Nud.
"What do you think it weighs?" asked Einan.
"A bit over a pound," replied Nud.
"Perfect. I think I can have my Mage Stones do the work to repeat the process."
Einan instructed his Mage Stones to make 49 more rings from the gold dust in the remaining cylinders. While they were heating, spinning and cooling, Chi made the same gestures Einan had made. The Raconet was pretending that he was a wizard. Einan and Nud didn't laugh, but they did grin at each other when Chi couldn't see them. As the rings formed, Nud suggested putting them in the pillowcases and tying them to various bony protrusions on Rocky's back.
"At least they'll be good for something," he said.
"And we don't want to advertise we're carrying 50 pounds of gold," noted Einan. "Though lumpy pillowcases might make people wonder what's in them."
"We're two humans, one a young wizard with a red mage stone riding on a wyvern," said Nud. "Anyone seeing us won't be wondering about lumpy pillowcases."
"Right," said Einan. "At least it hasn't taken us long."
When the last few rings were finished and bagged, Einan and Nud approached Rocky. Chi clambered up the wyvern's neck and began to dance on his scaly head. Rocky stretched, raising Chi 4 or 5 feet higher, then yawned, revealing an impressive collection of long, sharp teeth. Einan made Rocky a tasty ball of solidified sand to lick, while Nud anchored pillowcases filled with gold rings around the wyvern's back. He tried to make sure the extra weight was balanced. A minute later, they were all flying back to the castle.
"Where's the gate to Brendinus?" asked Einan.
"There are two of them," Nud replied. "One on the second floor of the castle and one in Daemon's Tower, but they won't do us any good."
"Why not?"
"I don't know how to open them," said Nud.
"And I'm not interested in trying to cram Rocky back into the pantry to use the gate to Taffern's Inn," said Einan. "It looks like we're going back to Furcher's Tower."
"Do we have to?" asked Nud. "She has an animated broom and dustpan that frightened me when I was small."
"I'll protect you," said Einan. "I think they're cute and useful."
"If you insist," said Nud.
Einan brought Rocky in for a landing near the 4 blue and white striped pillars outside the castle, marking the gate to the blue spiral tower.
"Blast!" said Einan, as he was about to trigger the gate. "I forgot to contact Merry."
Chapter 12. Daemon and Merry. Merry couldn't breathe after she entered a gate from the second floor of the castle in Menin Carrick to Brendinus. She'd been standing next to Daemon somewhere in the castle, leaning against an Athican-style fresco of cavorting nymphs and small winged horses. A moment later, a cloud of heavy fog enveloped her head. She couldn't see and started waving her arms. After a few seconds of asphyxiation, Daemon noticed her gyrations.
"Stop that," the old wizard commanded. "Up!"
The fog cloud thing rotated once around Merry, mussing her hair before it rose to float just below the whitewashed ceiling, covered in hundreds of multicolored arcane symbols. The young woman inhaled deeply several times, glaring at Daemon when she had more confidence she'd survive.
"What was that?"
asked Merry, once she could speak again.
"A servant to keep my rooms tidy," said Daemon. "It's not alive, but it has a tiny fleck of mage stone to animate it and is very protective.
It caught me by surprise, or I would have blasted it with a fireball."
"A transparent sphere of solidified sound around your head might be more effective," said Daemon.
"Only if you'd warned me so I could put it in place before I stepped through your gate," protested Merry.
"Sorry, I forgot the little thing even existed. It's so good at dusting with blasts of air that I didn't remember how it reacted to strangers, and it's been 2 decades. Usually I'm the only one here."
"Right," said Merry, feeling, rightly,
that Damon wasn't too pleased to have her tagging along. She thought about tying the old mage up in the bottom of a coracle and standing him in the marshes along the Ruthro when the midges were swarming. Mary smiled at Damon, and the old mage turned away as if he could sense what she was thinking. Then he changed the subject. "I used to have an animated broom and a congruency dustpan, but had to replace them with a fog cloud." "I think I saw them in Furcher's Tower," said Mary.
"No, those weren't mine," said Damon. "At least the broom wasn't. She kept the dustpan and made a new broom for herself. I sold mine to a farmer who needed help with irrigation."
"Why did you get rid of yours?" asked Mary.
"I gave it arms and taught it how to carry water for my bath," said Damon. "But things got out of hand."
Mary laughed, imagining an overflowing tub and a broom that wouldn't stop dumping buckets. Then she thought about it more. "Why didn't you just open a congruency to a hot spring to get warm water?"
"I was trying to impress a woman," said Damon.
Mary put a hand over her mouth to hide a grin.
"What?" asked Damon. "I was young and foolish. Not much older than you are."
"Did it work?" asked Mary. "You must have been close to her if you were bathing together."
"Oh, no, it wasn't like that," said Damon. "She was a wizard too, and I wanted to show off. I was teaching her in secret. I wanted to demonstrate how to animate objects. We didn't fall in love until later."
"I see," said Mary. Wheels were spinning in her head. She tried to imagine Damon at Einan's age and was only partly successful. But she resolved to draw the old mage out over time and learn more of the story. For now, she looked around the place they'd gated into. It was a large suite with white walls and dark oak wainscoting. A desk, like the one she'd seen in Damon's study, was in the centre of the room, with several low bookcases and cabinets in easy reach. She could see a wooden tub through an open door to one side, the location of the overly zealous broom's labours, she assumed, plus a bedchamber through another open door. A tall leaded glass window let in sunlight and stood across from what was probably the door to the suite. That door was barred. Mary could sense strong wards on it as well. Three tall, narrow tapestries were hung on the wall behind her. One showed a high waterfall descending past cliffs marked with bands of red and brown and gold. Its colours reminded her of Melyn Carrick. The second showed a night sky with hundreds of tiny stars formed from crossed silver threads, and one large star made from thousands of crystals sewn into a five-pointed pattern. The big star twinkled in the light streaming in the window. The third tapestry was more domestic. It showed a small family sharing a meal at a table by a fireplace. A boy, on the edge of manhood, was reading a book while the rest of the family ate dinner. The mother in the tapestry was trying to slide a plate of meat and bread toward her son. Mary smiled, wondering if the third tapestry depicted a happy time in Damon's own life, or if he'd just seen it and decided to buy it. From her position, she and Damon must have stepped through the first tapestry, which made sense. She'd have to ask Damon about a waterfall at Melyn Carrick when she got the chance, which wouldn't be soon.
"Come along," said Damon,
as he removed the bar on the suite's door and busied himself removing wards. Mary stood behind him, far enough away so she wouldn't distract him from his work. The animated fog cloud moved along the ceiling to hover over her head. When Mary looked up at it, the cloud turned dark and triggered small, silent cracks of lightning along its lower surface. While Damon's attention was elsewhere, Mary extended the fingers on her right hand and used five rods of tight light to move the cloud back to the far side of the ceiling. She didn't want to risk another attack. She also didn't understand why Damon would use a cloud to dust. Wind would just move the dust from one place to another, not permanently remove it like a dustcloth. Perhaps he'd created the cloud when he was young and foolish as well, she mused. I wonder who he was in love with. Soon, the door opened, and Damon let Mary out into a wide, deserted corridor.
We're in the royal palace in Brendinas, he said. There will be guards in the halls, more as we approach the king's rooms. So stay close to me and don't say anything. I didn't want you along, but you're here, and your father will hold me responsible for your safety.
Are you and my father friends?
Yes, said Damon.
The man's curt answers could be infuriating. Mary realized how uncharacteristic it had been of Damon for him to talk about himself earlier. Perhaps she should encourage him to talk more over the next few days by asking leading questions. When they turned the corner in a corridor, they saw a pair of guards in royal livery. They wore helmets, carried swords, and snapped into a defensive posture when they saw Damon and Merry. One of them looked familiar. It was Griffith. He stood stiffly at attention and didn't give any indication he'd recognize Merry, even though she knew he must have.
"What business do you have before the king?"
asked the guard, who looked marginally more experienced, a tall woman with brown hair to her shoulders.
"That's no concern of yours," said Damon. "I am the master mage of the kingdom, and I wish to speak to the king on matters of state."
The guard who challenged them muttered something that sounded like, "This is above my pay grade," and bowed.
"I will need to consult my superiors," she said.
Griffith remained on duty while the other guard opened the door, went in and closed it behind her. Merry winked at Griffith and stuck her tongue out at him, but he didn't react, though she thought she saw a twinkle in his eyes. She invoked her listening spell so she could follow what the absent guard said to her superior. "An old man and a girl are outside," she heard the guard say. "He says he's the Master Mage and didn't give her name. I thought that Dothan fellow was Master Mage."
"No, he's Senior Mage and only acting Master Mage. Wizards can be sticklers about getting their titles right."
One corner of Merry's mouth turned up. So were guardsmen and nobles, most especially nobles. She remembered once before his wonder year when Solder addressed an earl the way you'd address a baron. It took him more than a year to live it down.
"Let me get a look at him," said the guard superior. "There's a portrait of Master Mage Elderman in one of the upper halls. I'll see if this man looks anything like him."
"He just showed up at our door," said the guard. "We didn't have any word from other guards about him entering the palace. Maybe it is him. Isn't there supposed to be a suite for the Master Mage not far from here?"
"There is, but I've never seen it. The door to it is always barred," said the senior guard. "Return to your post. I'll handle things now."
"Yes, sir."
Merry put a serious look on her face as the first guard and her superior stepped out. The tall woman resumed her post while her superior, who turned out to be a somewhat older, medium-sized man with big shoulders, examined Damon. The old mage evidently resembled his portrait, because Damon and Merry were escorted into the next room, which Damon whispered was an antechamber to the royal study. Half a dozen guards, some with swords, some with pole arms, were arrayed around the room's inner door. There were several straight-backed wooden chairs against the walls, along with several more comfortable-looking chairs with arms and cushions in a corner.
"Wait for me here,"
said Damon, waving toward the comfortable chairs. After that gesture, he made a circular motion with his right hand, and the door to the king's study flew open. The guards in the antechamber froze. A dozen trumpets blared a fanfare, and Damon strode into the king's study like a victorious general with small bolts of lightning sparking around his head. The door slammed shut behind him. A bar fell, and a lock turned. Merry was impressed. The trumpets were a variation on the warding spell with barking dogs and crossbow bolts Dothan had taught her as one of her first spells. Transparent constructs of solidified sound sufficed for opening and closing the door, and surprise was all that was needed to freeze the guards long enough for Damon to act. It was good stagecraft, but only basic wizardry.
"Don't bother trying to open the door," she told the guards. "It's barred, locked, and warded."
The guard with big shoulders opened his mouth, but decided she wasn't someone who could help. Another guard looked at Merry, her eyes obviously asking what had just happened.
"Don't worry," said Merry. "He really is the Master Mage of Darren. Be glad he didn't decide to turn you all into frogs."
She didn't think that sort of transformation spell was possible, even with the most advanced wizardry, but it was an effective threat. The guards milled around near the door to the corridor and whispered. Merry could hear what they were saying. It was the usual covering-your-butt nonsense her father kept trying to stop his tenants from practicing. When her dar had caught Merry doing something she shouldn't, she made a point of being straightforward about admitting it, at least after that first dressing down she'd received for lying when she was 6. Merry picked the padded chair facing out from the corner and sat to wait for Damon. There was no telling how long he'd be with the young king. Perhaps he'd knock some sense into King Dario. From everything she'd heard, Dario needed it.
"I wonder if there's such a thing as a wisdom potion," she considered. "Perhaps that's more along the lines of what a hedge wizard could whip up."
There was a knock at the outer door. Griffith stuck his head inside and gestured to the broad-shouldered guard, who Merry heard say,
Send her in.
A tall woman, dressed in dark blue robes with her face concealed in a dark blue hood, entered and slowly walked over to stand in front of Mary. She seemed sad somehow, as if carrying a secret sorrow. Mary sensed something of wizardry about her.
"The Queen would like to speak to you," came in the woman's voice from inside her dark hood.
There was only one queen in Daron, Caris, the old queen, King Daroth the 24th's wife. Some said she'd been the true ruler of the kingdom at the end of her husband's reign, before he died of a broken heart 2 years ago, when Crown Prince Dari, his grandson and heir, had died. Young King Dario, the old king's great-grandson, was next in line, and had been crowned at 16.
"I'm sorry, I can't," said Mary. "My friend asked me to wait for him here."
"The guards will tell Elderman where to find you," said the woman in dark robes. And the queen was most insistent.
Mary stood and followed the old woman out of the antechamber. If it was a matter of disobeying Daemon or the queen, she knew which course was wiser.
Chapter 13. Mary. Queen Caris didn't have a formal audience chamber. Instead, she had a warm, well-lit sitting room, filled with comfortable furniture. Its walls were painted a soothing Daran blue and covered with stenciled silver stars. 3 well-padded chairs were positioned in a bay formed by a trio of tall windows. Dark blue velvet curtains, flocked with more silver stars, marked off an area to one side. A servant's alcove, perhaps. The queen sat with her back to the center window, a beam of sunlight turning the white hair, wreathing her face into a nimbus of soft gold. As Mary was escorted into the old queen's presence, it was clear that she wasn't as tall as she'd been in the royal portrait Mary had seen on a tour of Typhon's smaller royal palace. The queen no longer had her commanding stature, but she wasn't less for it. She seemed concentrated somehow, distilled down to her essence rather than reduced in any way. When the old queen smiled, Mary curtsied and bowed.
"One or the other would be fine, dear," said Queen Caris, "though I understand that you might be nervous. I don't bite, or at least not my friends."
"Your Majesty," said Mary,
bowing again, and giving a second quick curtsy with a twinkle in her eye.
"I think I'm going to like you, Meredith," said the queen. "You have your father's sense of humour. Please sit down."
The woman in dark blue robes and hood guided Mary to a chair across from Caris. Mary looked at the queen, received a confirming nod, and sat down. Her chair was very soft, almost like being hugged. The other woman sat in the remaining chair, a few inches to the right and behind Queen Caris. The 3 of them were alone in the room. The woman gestured, and Mary felt a transparent sphere of solidified sound form around them, preventing eavesdropping.
"I knew she was a wizard," thought Mary.
"Why do you think you are here?"
asked the queen, once the sphere was in place. Mary liked her directness. It reminded her of Furcher. She considered for a moment, then answered,
"To tell you what Daemon has been doing."
The queen looked over at the woman in dark blue robes.
"I told you she'd be quick."
The woman in dark blue robes nodded, and the queen turned back to Mary.
"Astri says little," said Queen Caris. "But here's much,"
the woman in dark robes completed with a bored tone.
"Forgive me, Your Majesty, but there's no need to feed Mary phrases that make me seem strange and ominous, much as you like to play up your personal wizard's mystique. It's bad enough you make me wear these hot robes."
"You know why they're necessary," said the Queen. "Go ahead. Take them off for the present. I don't see Meredith as the sort to gossip."
"But that's exactly what you're asking me to do about Daemon," said Mary, laughing. "I'm glad to tell you what I can. You are the queen, after all, and must have the kingdom's best interests at heart."
Mary stood to help Astri remove her robes and hood. The other woman was wearing a soft, pale blue linen shirt that reached her knees beneath them. Astri's mouth silently moved to say, "Thank you." Merry nodded. Astri was older than Merry had assumed, a grandmother rather than someone her mother's age. Her hair was short and grey, with only a few hints of red. She had a wise, wrinkled face that fit well with her voice and manner. A rich blue light radiated from what must be her mage stone, hidden just below the collar of her shirt. Merry smiled at Astri. The other woman looked familiar, but Merry couldn't figure out why. "It will come to me," she thought. The two returned to their seats, and the Queen resumed their conversation.
"Don't be so trusting and assume anyone royal has the kingdom's best interest at heart, especially if you ever speak with Princess Gwynnet."
"King Dario's mother, you mean?"
"Correct," said Astri. "She's been trying to kill Caris for half a decade."
Merry raised an eyebrow, glad her father had decided to leave court before she'd been born if casual attempts at murder were commonplace.
"I'm glad she hasn't been successful, Your Majesty," said Merry.
"So am I," said the Queen,
who grinned at Merry, showing a sparkle in her aged eyes.
"Try to keep the use of my title to once every 10 minutes, my dear. When we're alone, that is. You have permission to call me Caris in such circumstances."
"Yes, Your Majesty."
The Queen laughed like someone used to laughing.
"I sense Dothan's influence as well as Derry's, don't you?" said Astri, leaning close to Caris and smiling. "Clearly," said the Queen. "She will pick up even more bad habits from Fercher."
"That's a certainty," said Astri.
"By the way," said Queen Caris, "don't taste any food brought to my chamber until Astri has inspected it magically. At least one meal a day contains some poison that has to be neutralized."
"That's terrible," said Merry.
Who would want to poison Caris, the beloved old queen? Princess Gwynnet, apparently.
"Things are different in the capital than they are in the Ruthra Valley," said Astri. "Princess Gwynnet has little interest in the well-being of the kingdom, and quite a lot in the well-being of Princess Gwynnet."
"I've known a few like her," said Merry.
"The late Crown Prince, my grandson and Dario's father, was wrapped around Gwynnet's finger," said Queen Caris. "So long as she gave him plenty of time for hunting and practicing skill at arms, he was happy. She was even good at making sure he kept to his schedule of royal duties, reviewing troops, inspecting fortifications, dedicating bridges and such."
"Don't tell me she tried to poison him."
"I won't," said the Queen. "But as far as Astri and I can tell, she didn't. He was too useful to her, since she could pull his strings and rule in all but name, once my husband died."
"The Crown Prince died of a clot formed by a blow from a wooden practice sword just above his right knee," said Astri. "Dothan and I examined his body and confirmed it. It flowed to his lungs and killed him. That's not the sort of thing Gwynnet could have arranged."
"I see," said Merry.
Though she was taking in so much new information, she wasn't sure that she did. Dothan's ring for contacting Einan began to vibrate on her finger. But she didn't do anything about it. It would be inappropriate during a royal audience. She'd reach out to Einan as soon as she was free. She put the hand with the ring in her lap and covered it with her other hand.
"Enough about Gwynnet," said Queen Caris. "Back to Eldamon."
"He asked me to call him Daemon," Merry noted.
"That's just so he can see the look of surprise on people's faces when they realize he's the master mage of Darren," said Astri, shaking her head but smiling.
"I don't know him very well, and not for very long," said Merry. "I first met him early this morning, when Fercher and I flew to the Coombe to stop Vero and wizards from Tamloch trying to steal green mage stones from a quarry."
"We know about that," said the Queen.
"Then we gated to an inn in Ryas and met people in Daemon's network who were spying on King Tuathal and Vero."
"Vero is Tuathal's younger brother, if Fercher hasn't told you that already," said Astri.
"How's Solda?"
"Doing well," said Merry.
before she realized what she'd said. The other women smiled at her, so she kept talking.
He seems to be a natural spy.
Of course, said the Queen. And he'll make a good baron.
Mary realized another major plus to having her older brother alive, and now understood why her father was willing to introduce her to Dothan and let her study wizardry instead of insisting she had to take over the barony in the future.
We learned that King Tuathel paid King Bajani of Bitherland to send 500 dragon ships up the Brynaven to sack Brendinas. They should be here in a couple of days.
Astrid nodded.
We know about that too, and they're more like a day away, maybe less.
Mary could feel her face get warmer as Queen Caris and Astrid's interrogation continued.
Do you know about the treaty with the Eagle People and the legions marching here from Nova Eberacum?
Two of them, I believe, said the Queen.
And 60 purple wizards, added Astrid.
Mary stood up and paced. She was feeling like the conversation was making her brain turn upside down and sideways. She wished she could talk to Aenon. He'd help her get her thoughts in order with an innocent question.
Is there anything you don't know?
Asked Mary, nearly losing her temper.
Yes, said the Queen. Why is Elderman in the palace?
He hasn't set foot here in over 40 years, said Astrid.
That's news to me, said Mary.
I have no idea. Why don't you ask him yourselves?
Chapter 14. Daemon.
Are you the young fool who's put the kingdom into such a precarious position? Asked Daemon, as trumpets continued to sound and the door slammed behind him.
King Dario leaned back unperturbed in a chair by his desk a few yards from the door. His long muscular legs were extended out over one corner of its surface, with his dark blue boots crossed. He held a quill in one hand.
"Are you the old fool who left the kingdom without its master mage for 2 generations?" asked Dario, without raising his voice.
"Your great-grandfather was twice the man you are!" shouted Daemon.
"My great-grandfather's mind was as lost as a fool on his wander gear for 3 years before he died," said Dario. "You might have done something to help, but you chose a self-imposed exile over service to Darren."
"Who are you to judge me?" asked Daemon.
"Your rightful king," Dario replied.
"No,"
Daemon began. Then he closed his jaw and intentionally cut off what he'd been about to say, squeezing his hands into fists and relaxing them. The trumpet fanfare stopped, and tiny flashes of lightning that had been dancing around the wizard's head ceased, leaving a faint smell of ozone in the king's study.
"Your Majesty, forgive an old man's impertinence," said Daemon, approaching the king's desk deferentially.
When he was close enough, Daemon abruptly tugged the young king's legs off the desk, stepped close, and leaned over the young ruler. He tried to grab the king by his collar, but Dario was fast enough to block Daemon and hold the wizard's wrists. The two were locked together, their faces nearly touching.
"We're days away from utter ruin, you fool," said Daemon. "Fertra and Dothan are bringing you an agreement from Nova Eberacum to enlist their support. Don't behave like the idiot I've heard you are and ignore them. Sign the agreement, and we may yet save the kingdom and your throne."
Dario released Daemon and pushed the old wizard back to arm's length. The king tickled the end of Daemon's nose with a nearby quill and picked up a sheet of parchment from his desk. It was only half the size of a typical parchment, and one side was cut in a zigzag pattern.
"You mean this agreement, old man?"
said Dario, waving it in front of Daemon. "The one I signed 30 minutes ago. The governor's copy should already be in his hands, and his legions will be here later today, thanks to wide gates Fircher is building."
"What?"
said Daemon, clutching the edge of the desk for support.
"She's figured out how to build wide gates, and she's showing the Roma. What is she thinking?"
"She's thinking she's saving the kingdom," said Dario. "Fircher said she's lined up wizards here for our end of the gate, and is headed to Nova Eberacum to help the Roma wizards with their end."
Daemon shook his head and took the parchment from Dario's desk. He read the agreement and saw the fresh-cut indentations where the copy for Ocaden's province had been separated from Darren's. Daemon looked like a warrior who just caught a solid blow across the helm from a heavy wooden practice sword.
King Dario moved a chair behind him and helped the old wizard sit down. He poured Daemon a goblet of watered wine from a sideboard and watched the older man drink it down.
"Is that better?" asked the young king.
"A bit," said Daemon. "So you're not a fool, then?"
"No more than we all are," said Dario, "though not to hear my mother tell it. She thinks I'm a great fool, and tells me so at every opportunity."
"Princess Gwynedd truly is a fool, then, to treat you that way," said Daemon.
"What does that make you, barging in to frighten and overawe me into authorizing an alliance with the Eagle People that I'd already signed as soon as it arrived?"
Daemon shook his head slowly, as if making sure it was still attached to his neck.
"There's no fool like an old fool," he said.
"Especially an old fool who quotes from his own book of epigrams," said Dario with a smile.
A small nod marked Daemon's response, accepting the teasing.
"It's disconcerting for me to meet you like this," added the young king.
"Disconcerting for you, perhaps, but embarrassing for me. I've been told you were utterly unsuited to be king."
"And I've wanted to meet you for half my life. Master Mage Elderman, the wizard who froze the Abernoth and brought our armies to the gates of Nova Eberacum. You are one of my heroes."
Daemon rested his chin on his palm, supporting his arm with his elbow on the desk. He smiled at the younger man and shrugged his shoulders.
"I'm no hero, Your Majesty. Just an old man with a habit of running away from trouble."
"But you didn't run," said Dario. "You came when my grandfather called. I've read all the stories about you in the histories, and must have all your epigrams committed to memory."
"What comes after 'there's no fool like an old fool'?" asked Daemon.
"One of my favourites," said Dario. "Justice is a sword, mercy a healing potion."
"I think that's right," said Daemon. "When you get to be my age, it's easy to forget small details."
Dario waved at a bookshelf a few feet away.
"There's a copy over there if you'd like me to check."
"No need, I'm sure you're correct. I'm honoured you've read my book."
"I've got three copies. One here, one tucked into a cushion in the throne room, and one on a stand by my bed."
"I'm unworthy," said Daemon, without a hint of humility.
He grinned at Dario and began to feel better. The old wizard sat up straight and sifted his goblet. Dario refilled it and poured watered wine for himself.
"I've wanted to ask you for something for years," said the young king. "Did you ever discover any clues in your search for my great-aunt Seren?"
"That's a long story, my liege," said Daemon. "One best told when we don't have 500,000 dragon ships heading upriver in our direction."
"And when we've got something stronger to fortify us than watered wine?"
"That too," said Daemon. "When will the Bifferland fleet arrive?"
"About the same time the legions get here," said Dario. "It will be a close thing. But the Roma should be on the east bank of the Brynaven, 10 miles south of the city later today. The dragonship raiders will get to that point first thing tomorrow morning. The royal army is marching down the west bank, and with luck, and help from you, we can smash the Bifferlanders between the Hammer of Darren and the Anvil of the Roma. Which brings me to a very important question."
"What is it?" asked Daemon.
He suspected he knew what Dario was about to ask.
"Do you think you're up to freezing the Brynaven instead of the Abernoth?"
Chapter 15. Fircher and Dothan.
"Why do I have to carry the bag of Maidstone dust while you carry the agreement?" asked Dothan.
"Fine," said Fircher, taking the bag from Dothan and slinging it over her shoulder while continuing to hold the cut parchment with the copy of the agreement for Ocuden's province.
She doubled her pace, and Dothan had to speed up to stay with her as they walked from a secret gate in a townhouse in Nova Eberacum toward the governor's palace. They saw soldiers and supply wagons gathering along the paved broad way from the northern wall defending the city to the palace. Dothan was a few inches shorter than Fircher, so he had to lengthen his stride as well as move faster.
"Do you have your token for the gate guards at the palace?" he asked.
"Do you?" Fircher replied in a serious tone.
Both laughed. They'd fallen back into the teasing banter they'd developed as neighbours along the Ruthro and allies on the Conclave.
"Why are we carrying a bag full of blue Maidstone dust?" asked Dothan.
What do you mean, we?
Why are you carrying it, then?
Because I know how to get the Roma legions to Brendinas faster, Furch replied. I'd intended to use the dust on a demonstration for Dario, on speeding up troop movements, but hadn't had a chance to show him yet.
I was wondering why you had a 25-pound bag of Maidstone dust in your rooms in Brendinas, said Dothan. You finally figured out how Damon made the extra-wide gate from the kitchen to the banquet hall in the castle at Melencarrig.
Sort of, said Furcher. I had some help.
And not from Damon, I assume.
You assume correctly. I'm hoping all this blue Maidstone dust will help power a gate big enough for a legion to use.
The street around them was crowded and bustling with soldiers and ordinary city residents. Oxcart wheels in need of grease squeaked like thousand-pound mice, and the pair of wizards were jostled more than once by passers-by as they headed south along the street's rough cobblestones. Dothan wished he had his familiar Roush with him. The big dog would have helped clear them a path.
"Did you get it from Carrick Glass?"
asked Dothan, after dodging a woman carrying buckets of beer on a yoke across her back. He knew proper Roma citizens preferred wine, but the legions of Quintilius Martius Africanus from the land south of Egypt had a taste for beer brewed from sorghum. Furcher used a quick sidestep to protect the agreement from the sharp elbows of a centurion striding past it in the opposite direction.
"Of course, it pays to use the best when you can get it," she said.
"I have a table in my library with a top made from Carrick glass blue marble," Dothan replied.
"That no one can appreciate because you keep it covered with books and documents," teased Furcher.
"But I know it's there, and that's enough," said Dothan. "Did the quarrymaster charge you an arm and a leg for the dust?"
"No, he gave it to me for free," said Furcher. "But I had to promise him a week of work around the quarry in return for two particularly fine magestones his men found while cutting blue marble. My new magestone is one of them."
"And Mary's is the other?"
"Yes."
"Have her help you work off your debt," said Dothan. "It'll be good training for her."
"The thought had never crossed my mind," said Furcher, her tone making it clear that doing so had been part of her plan since she'd taken on her new apprentice.
"Sorry," said Dothan, in a tone that indicated he wasn't. "It's not like we don't have other more important priorities at the moment."
"Do you think?" asked Furcher.
They were almost at the north gate to the governor's palace. The street was still crowded with people. There were many tall, long-limbed men and women from Roma's African provinces, and a smaller number in the garb of the empire, who could have otherwise been at home in the markets of Brendinas.
"They must be connected to the legions from Samartia," realized Furcher.
The settlers from the White and Green Isles, who had populated Darren and Tamlok, had originally come from lands to the north and east of Roma. Everyone avoided walking on the paving stones nearest to the gate, however. None of the passers-by wanted to get too close to the squad of guards in brightly polished loricas, holding unsheathed short swords and barring entry. Dothan removed his token from his pouch and took the bag of blue Maidstone dust from Furcher. She got out her own token, and the two wizards crossed the empty space to present themselves.
"Please tell Letitia her guests have arrived," said Dothan,
to the senior gate guard, extending his token. He smiled at the woman and knew the sack of dust on his back made him look like a peddler.
"Go away, old man,"
said a young guard to one side, wearing a helm that was slightly too big for him.
"The liveries are at the west gate, near the kitchens." "Stultio, report to barracks and have them send us a replacement, then do 10 laps around the city in full kit on the double," said the senior guard.
The dark face of the young guard got darker, as blood rushed to his cheeks once he'd realized what he'd done. He bowed to the senior guard, then to Dothan and Furcher, and withdrew into the palace.
"My apologies, good gentles," said the senior guard, smiling at the wizards. "He's a new recruit. I'll put him on night soil collection duties for a few weeks, and I'm sure he will learn from the experience."
"No doubt," said Furcher.
"That's the way you handle an apprentice,"
said Dothan, leaning close to Furcher.
"As if Mary didn't have you dancing to her tune more than half the time, I'm sure," Furcher replied, handing her token to the senior guard.
The guard shook her head at the wizard's byplay.
"Enforcing discipline is a constant struggle," she said. "Letitia told me to keep an eye out for you and escort you to her as soon as you arrived. Follow me."
"I got resin on my robes," grumbled Dothan.
"Adjust your spell to banish water from them so it works on tree sap," said Furcher.
It's mostly water anyway. There's no point in bothering with it until the job is done.
We finished laying pieces of obsidian between the trees, said a short, stout, older wizard in purple robes, with a graying dome of dark hair and intricate facial tattoos. She hadn't found it easy to bend down and place black volcanic glass in the fresh plaster, now hardening in a trench between two massive maples, but had worked diligently. Thank you, Mofuta, said Fircher, as she helped Dothan finish sprinkling blue magestone dust on the resin they'd spread up and down the trunk of the left-hand tree. Fircher had already completed preparations for the tree on the right.
I had the obsidian-crusted rope tied off, said a second purple-robed wizard. He was floating on a flying disc and leaning against the left-hand tree. This one was young, tall, male, and thin enough to almost disappear in profile. Fircher thought he looked like a version of Mary's lover, carved from coal instead of ivory.
Excellent, said Dothan. Don't tip over, Felix.
He won't have any problems, said Mofuta. I'm the one who taught him to fly.
Dothan and Fircher walked back 50 feet to the right-hand tree to double-check their work and have a few moments to talk. Dothan leaned close to Fircher's ear and whispered, Are you sure it's wise to teach these two how to make an extra wide gate?
It can't be helped, snapped Fircher, and the gate will only be stable until something breaks the lines.
We'll have to make sure the legions and their supply wagons don't damage the obsidian, said Mofuta from the left-hand tree. I didn't need a spell to overhear you, by the way. I could see your lips moving.
Dothan laughed and Fircher frowned. Dothan should have put up a privacy sphere, but he hadn't taken the time. The short Roma wizard moved out of the way as her younger colleague brought his flying disc down to the base of the left-hand tree.
We've got boards to cover the obsidian on the ground, said Felix, and we'll send the wagons through after the soldiers, just in case.
Are they ready to march? Asked Fircher.
She was glad Intira and other members of the old queen's faction in the conclave were handling the Daran side of the wide gate. Mofuta stepped on her flying disc and rose above the tops of the great maples. Felix and two other Roma wizards joined her to assist with the gate's top, bottom, and sides.
They're ready, Mofuta replied.
Fircher drew on the power of her new mage stone. It wasn't as smooth as it had been with her original stone and setting, but it was enough. A curtain of interlaced blue and black magic appeared, framed by the mage stone dust on the tree trunks and the imported obsidian pieces above and below. The magical interface flickered, showing a broad, grassy meadow on the other side. The Brenavon's blue water flowed beyond the meadow, and off to the right, on the other side of the river, they could see the highest pennants above the far-off walls of Brendinus.
"Send them through," said Dothan.
"Why not connect the gate on the other side of the river, closer to the city?" asked Felix.
"Think about it," said Mofuta. "We can fight dragonship raiders from this side before they reach Daran's capital."
"Oh," said Felix. "But we're less of a threat ourselves, because we'd still need to cross the river to attack Brendinus."
"Precisely," said Mofuta.
Dothan and Fircher nodded at her. They all smiled at Felix.
"How are we to engage the dragonship riders without ships of our own or siege engines?" Felix asked. "Can't they just sail past us?"
"Yes," said Mofuta. "How are we going to force engagement?"
"We have that in hand," said Dothan, glancing over at Fircher to ensure that they did.
"Yes," said Fircher. "Well in hand."
She hoped Damon's skill with freezing magic hadn't diminished in the past quarter century. "No," Fircher considered. "He's still the coldest man I know, with the possible exception of Vero."
Chapter 16. Nud and Einan.
"She's not answering," said Einan, as they flew east from the blue spiral tower on the Ruthro.
He almost said Gualoeaden for the fifth time, but decided against it. Mary had to have a good reason not to respond.
"Your girlfriend must be busy," said Nud. "Damon has a knack for causing trouble, and they're probably both in the middle of it. I hope she can head off his worst impulses."
"Thanks," said Einan. "That's so reassuring."
He consciously copied the tone Braith used to mock his attempts to be optimistic.
"You don't understand," said Nud. "You've only been around Damon for a few days. I've been living with him in Melyn Carrig for more than a decade.
When he's not running away from problems, he's creating them.
I'll take your word for it.
Einan's brain was still whirling with worry, but at least the weather didn't match the storms of concern roiling in his head. The skies were filled with fluffy clouds, and not the sort that could quickly turn into thunderheads. Rocky seemed to enjoy a chance to stretch his wings for a long flight, and happily followed the red ball of solidified sound Einan projected in front of him. Chi had resumed hanging onto the big wyvern's neck after finding one of the pillowcases filled with gold rings uncomfortable napping. The raconette had wrapped his tail around one of Rocky's bony projections, leaned back into the angle of the wyvern's cervical vertebrae, and fallen asleep. Nud and Einan didn't speak for a quarter of an hour, watching Western Darren flow below them, before Einan turned to face Nud.
"Where are we headed?" Einan asked.
"Brendinas, of course," said Nud. "I thought we'd fly to the capital, then follow the Brenhaven south to locate the Biffalanders."
Einan thought about his lessons from Euclid's Elements. Nud had described taking two sides of a right-angle triangle.
"Wouldn't it be easier to follow the hypotenuse?"
"What?"
asked Nud.
"You know," said Einan,
sketching something vaguely familiar in the air with one hand.
"Why can't we cut off the corner?"
"Oh," said Nud, "that's easy. That won't help, because we don't know exactly where the dragon ship on Marder is on the river. And I don't know how to get to the Lower Brenhaven from here."
"That makes more sense," said Einan.
"If we don't fly east to Typhod, then a bit southeast to Brendinas, I'm not sure I can find the Brenhaven."
"Isn't it a big river? Almost as big as the Moraven?"
"It's not that big, but it gets wide south of the capital, according to the maps I've seen back in Melyn Carrig," said Nud.
"That's what I remember too," said Einan, "even though I was only in the map room once. Why can't we start flying southeast now, cross the Moraven south of Typhod and its crossbowmen, avoid the capital, and come up on the Biffalanders from the rear, where they won't expect us?"
"Not a bad thought, but we don't know how far the dragonship raiders have travelled up the river. What if they're too far ahead of us?"
"Then we'll spot the smoke from them burning estates downriver from Brendinas," said Einan.
"I expect the people living on those estates would be happier if we could bribe the Biffalanders to turn round before their homes and barns were torched."
"You have a point," said Einan. "I know I would."
"Good," said Nud. "For a minute there I thought you were being as callous as a clanlander."
Einan shook his head slowly. People in the Coombe had been dealing with clanland attacks and skirmishes for generations. They weren't something to joke about.
"Maybe we can angle just a little bit southeast," Einan suggested. "We could still bypass Brendinas, but hit the Brenhaven, not far below the capital."
Nud smiled over at Einan.
"I understand now," he said. "You overheard Daemon telling me about the Conclave testing you and want to avoid them."
"Uh-huh," said Einan. "At least until I know more about what the testing involves, and we've paid off the Biffalanders."
"I can't fault your logic there," said Nud. "Biffalanders first, then the Conclave. It's a matter of priorities. Start Rocky heading slightly southeast now, and we'll see where we hit the Brenhaven."
"I like that plan better," said Einan.
Something that had been tight in his chest relaxed a few degrees. The thought of dealing with the Conclave, especially without Daemon's guidance, had been weighing on his mind, along with Merry's unresponsiveness.
"It's too bad we couldn't have detoured back to the Coombe," said Nud. "I would have appreciated a more substantial snack."
"You just wanted to see my sister again."
"That too," said Nud.
"I'm not hungry enough to turn around," said Einan. "And there are states south of us depending on our speedy arrival."
"Along with the entire population of the capital," added Nud.
He smiled at Einan, hanging on beside him.
"Prepare for double time," said Einan,
accelerating the ball of solidified sound Rocky was chasing.
"Let's see how fast Rocky can fly."
Wind streamed past them, ruffling their hair and making their cloaks and jackets rattle. Einan created small lenses of solidified sound over their eyes to serve as goggles. He even made a tiny pair for Chi. It wasn't long before they saw a broad river threading between newly planted fields like a blue ribbon. Nud pointed.
"Is that the Moraven?" asked Einan. "I think I can see the walls of Typhod off to the north."
It must be, said Nerd. We're on course, I think. Turn a bit to the south, so we'll miss the capital.
Turning, said Einan, as he moved the ball of solidified sound.